God, he's so obnoxious. She releases a light, fluttering laugh.
No, we don't want to cut your hours. We just want to make sure that, although the company holds no responsibility for the events of last week, you don't feel yourself adversely affected such that continuing to carry out your responsibilities here as per your contract might now or at some future date result in anxiety, depression or similar conditions. Also that you're satisfied that the company has made available to you such time and resources as you might need in the course of making a full recovery.
Suspicion gives way to the blank look again. Lindsay takes a card from her personal organizer.
If you do feel the need to talk to someone, this is the counselling service available to all company employees. It's a special low-cost line.
He flips the card between his fingers. It's hard to be sure he's taking any of this in, but it doesn't look like he's planning on milking them over the tragic event. She can go back and tell Senan to relax, and the relief and pleasure she imagines flooding to Senan's face at this inspires an unexpected wave of sympathy and gratitude for Jean. She promises him a prompt response on his appraisal, and as she leaves, she is thinking that even if it hasn't occurred to him to sue them, God, if it had been an Irish guy behind the counter that night, cha-ching, she may bump him up to level 2 anyway. It's only 20 euro extra a month, after all. Halfway to the door, she pauses, imagining she can see a trace of strawberry syrup still there on the floor tiles. And she disappears into a little daydream about Senan writing her name there. But instead of dying, getting up and staring deep into her, Lindsay's, eyes, and unscrewing his wedding ring and tossing it over his shoulder. They'd have a house in Bald's Bridge near the park, and another in Connemara by the sea, and three little boys who Senan would drive into Seabrook College every morning. But she wouldn't let them come in here. Once you find out what's in those doughnuts, they're actually really disgusting. The intervening days between the tragic event, as it's become known, and the funeral mass in Seabrook Parish Church, are a dreamlike mixture of chaos and odd, affectless serenity, like watching a riot on television with the sound turned down. Classes are suspended, and in the ensuing vacuum, reality too seems on hold. The boundaries and precepts that ordinarily govern the school day, that had seemed until now like fundamental laws of the universe, simply no longer there. The ringing of the bell at 3/4-hour intervals, just a meaningless sound. The corridors full of people wandering around like drones in some computer simulation. As if to compound the weirdness, parents keep bursting through the double doors at every hour and charging up the stairs to besiege the acting principal. From their expressions, blending the implacable determination of the irate customer with a touching, infant-like helplessness, one might think these parents, many of whose sons are not even in the same year as Daniel Juster, to be more upset than anyone else. And maybe they are. Maybe for them, Howard thinks, Seabrook College really is a bulwark of tradition, stability, constancy, all of the things it says in the brochure. And so, in spite, no doubt, of their best intentions, they can't help viewing the tragic event, the suicide of this boy they do not know, as a hostile act, a kind of vandalism, a swear word wantonly scratched into the sleek black paint of their lives. Why would he do such a thing? They ask, over and over, wringing their hands. And the automator tells them the same thing he tells the newspaper men and women that appear at the school gates, outside the doors, skulking down Our Lady's Hall, that the school is conducting a full investigation, that he will not rest until an explanation is found, but that the number one priority for all of them now must be the care and reassurance of the boys. On the day of the service, the school chapel being deemed too small for the purpose, the entire year of 200 boys, accompanied by Howard and 5 other teachers, makes its way, crocodile fashion, down the perimeter path and out the gates to Seabrook Village. Ordinarily, This type of operation would be a logistical nightmare. Today they marched the mile to the parish church with barely a sound. The boys' faces have the same pasty, just-scrubbed, vaguely otter-like look they have when they've just got out of bed, and they flinch as they cross the church threshold, as if the coffin were not sitting there inertly between the aisles, but hanging over them like a rod of untold power, a splinter of something supermassive and implacable that's come spinning down like that inscrutable black slab in 2001, from somewhere dread and ulterior, to call time on their flimsy, Wendy House lives. Just before the mass begins, a contingent of girls from St. Bridget's is led in by a nun. Heads turn, and a restrained but audible murmur of displeasure indicates that the girl at the heart of the affair is among them. Howard identifies her from the newspaper pictures, though slighter than she looked there, and younger, hardly more than a child, delicate features rhythmically appearing and disappearing behind a veil of black hair. The story going around is that Juster, improbable as it seems, had some kind of romantic entanglement with this girl, which on the fateful night, less improbably, came to an end. She certainly has a face custom-made for heartbreak. Still, Howard struggles to reconcile this melodrama with the nondescript boy who sat in the middle row of his history class. The organ sounds, and the boys rise in unison. Tiernan Marsh leads the choir into the hymn that opens all Seabrook College ceremonies. Here I am, Lord. While they sing, Howard surreptitiously scans the rows of young faces, staring deliberately ahead, muscles tensed against any expression of emotion. The hymn is so beautiful, though, and the choir's voice so sweet, that even as he watches, the fault lines spread, eyes redden, heads drop. At the end of one bench, he sees tears coursing down Tom Roach's cheeks. It is shocking, like seeing your dad cry. Turning away, he finds himself looking right into Father Green's eyes. He bows his head hastily, and they sit again. Father Foley says Mass with his lips too close to the microphone. The loudspeakers pop with every plosive, making the boys wince.
"How telling it is,"
he says in his sermon, shaking his illustrious, golden-locked head.
"That Daniel's short life should come to its end in a restaurant devoted to doughnuts. For in some ways, is our modern way of life not comparable to one of these doughnuts? Junk food that satisfies only temporarily, that offers a quick fix, but has at the center of it a hole. Is that not indeed the shape of any society that has lost touch with God? At Seabrook College, we strive to fill this hole with tradition, with spiritual education, with healthy outdoor activity, and with love. Today, the report card that our Holy Father has given us tells us that we must try harder. Daniel is united with him now. But for the other boys and for ourselves too, we must learn to be more watchful, more vigilant against the forces of darkness in the many alluring guises those forces have learned to hide themselves.
A photographer is waiting on the steps after the service. As the doors open, he springs into position. But before he can snap a single shot, Tom Roach has charged over to accost him. The man half rises, hands wheeling, arguing his case. Tom does not listen, keeps jostling him backwards till the photographer loses his footing and stumbles down the steps. The automator places a discreet hand on Tom's shoulder. But the man is already on his way, complaining bitterly about censorship. After the cemetery, there is a reception in the school. The St. Bridget's girls are whisked away by their guardians, but many of the second years come back for weak tea and drooping, plasticky ham and cheese sandwiches, served from a trestle table in Our Lady's Hall. The slim man in the dark suit talking to one of the priests is Juster's father. He looks exhausted, wrung out, like he spent the last 7 days in a spin cycle. His wife is washed up against him, clinging lifelessly to his arm like seaweed, with no pretense of listening to the priest's small talk. Howard searches about for Farley, wondering how long he has to wait before he can politely leave. Then...
Ah, Howard, there you are.
A voice says at his ear.
Someone I'd like you to meet.
Before he can protest or escape, the automator has steered him right up to the bereaved parents. They greet the stuttering interloper without pleasure. On hearing his name, however, Juster's father's face quite changes, opens, in a curiously literal way, making him seem younger, recalling his son. The history teacher, he says.
That's right.
Howard is not sure how to pitch his smile. Daniel used to talk about your class. You're doing the First World War at the moment.
Yes, yes.
Howard burbles gratefully, seizing on it as if for a life belt, but then unable to find the words to advance the conversation. He was telling me about it just the other day. As a matter of fact, he had a great-grandfather who fought in the war, on my wife's side. Isn't that right, honey? Juster's mother's lips briefly approximate a smile. Then she pinches her husband's sleeve, and he leans over so she can bring a cupped hand to his ear. He nods, and, extending the smile and bowing to Howard and the others, she withdraws and makes her way down the hall. "My wife is very sick," he says, almost in passing. Then, in a more meditative tone, "Yes, his name was Molloy, William Henry Molloy. He served in Gallipoli, though, not on the Western Front. I think Sinead still has some bits and pieces belonging to him somewhere in the house. Would they be of interest to you? I could dig them out for you, if you like."
"Oh, well, I wouldn't want you to go to any trouble."
"No trouble. No trouble." The man drifts off, tracing a thumbnail along his lower lip, then, resurfacing, says quite conversationally, "He didn't want me to tell anyone about his mum. I don't suppose he mentioned her to you, did he?" He flashes ringed eyes at Howard, who takes a moment to realize that they are talking about Juster again. Stiffly, he shakes his head. "Kids are so secretive at that age. I don't need to tell you that, I'm sure." The man smiles softly at Howard. "Do you have children yourself?"
"Not yet,"
Howard says, visited as he speaks by an image of his empty house, the floor covered with pizza boxes and unfinished games of Sudoku. They have definite opinions on how things should be done. He smiles the weird faraway smile again. "I shouldn't have listened to him, of course. I realize that now. I should have told someone to keep an eye on him. He needn't have known. I was just so distracted. You know, an illness like that becomes such a marathon. The endless waiting for test results, for the next round of treatment. And at the back of my mind, I suppose I was thinking the same thing he was. That if we all just sat tight, maybe the whole thing would disappear. I didn't think about the pressure it was putting him under, coping with it all alone. Now it's too late." He trails off, lifts the spoon to stir his tea, replaces it without raising the cup to his lips, while Howard flails about for some words of consolation. "But Mr. Costigan tells me..." It is the other man who speaks first, addressing Howard with a resolute air, "that you talked to Daniel on a couple of occasions. I wanted to thank you for that. I'm glad he knew there was somewhere he could go."
"You're welcome."
The words whistle faintly through Howard's lips, like his mouth has been shot full of Novocaine. He reaches out to shake the hand the man extends, as inside he feels his body turn to ashes. Then, gratefully, he steps aside, as Tom approaches to pay his respects, his handsome, lean-jawed face heavy with compassion. Juster's mother is waiting in the car outside, and it is not long before her husband, thanking the faculty again, leaves to join her. Shortly afterwards, the caterers begin to stow the dirty crockery. The crowd has dissipated, and the remnant that continues to the ferry is made up of teachers alone. The mood they bring in with them is broody and mean, and drinking at 3 o'clock the worst thing for it. In an hour, everyone is tipsy and unstable. The women, most of whom are mothers, dab at tears. Emergent sunlight streams through the window and blares from the hideous floral carpet, combining with the beer to make Howard's head ache. He wants to go home, but is locked into a corner by Farley, who's drinking double whiskies and has embarked on a long, bitter diatribe that has no real subject but keeps coming back to Father Foley's sermon.
He's supposed to be a man of God, and he gets up there and spouts this stupid, vacuous... I mean, did he think for a second about how people might feel?
I didn't think it was that bad,
Howard says blandly.
I mean, no worse than you'd expect.
For God's sake, life is like a donut. Has the poor kid not undergone enough without being dragged into Starr's a metaphor for modern society?
Well, he did have a point,
Howard says.
I agree, it may not have been tasteful.
Juster didn't die from eating a donut, Howard. He died from a fucking giant overdose of painkillers.
I know that, but the stuff about junk food and the world we're handing down to these kids...
I'm not denying that for one second. It's a shitty fucking world, no question. And right from the off, these kids are in the crosshairs, being told to buy this, buy that, lose weight, dress like a hooker, get bigger muscles. By grown men, Howard. It's grown men and women doing this. I mean, the cynicism of it is unbelievable. But my point is, my point...
He stalls, head veering in vague circles like an errant compass needle.
That fool, that silly old man and the automator and all of them, they carry on like it's outside. All the bad stuff is outside, and we're this embattled force protecting them from it. When it's us too, Howard, when we're filling them with our own brand of bullshit about tradition and whatever... Setting them up to take their places at the top of the shit heap, like this is some noble thing, when it's all just money. And who they are is incidental. They're just the means of allowing Seabrook to keep being fucking Seabrook.
I don't see what this has got to do with Juster,
Howard says quietly, aware of how loud Farley has got.
No one cares, Howard. That's what it's got to do with him. If someone had been looking out for that kid, this wouldn't have happened. I guarantee you, I guarantee you.
Over Howard's mumbled protests.
But no one was, because no one cares. Instead, we just pay lip service to caring, like we pay lip service to charity and all those Christian values we supposedly stand for, while we're slumped in front of our incredibly high-resolution plasma TVs, or we're driving off to our holiday homes in our SUVs. Like, don't you think it's a fucking joke calling that a Christian life? Do you think fucking Jesus would have driven around in an SUV?
Here, Tom interjects roughly. They look up. He is glaring at them intently through reddened, bleary eyes. A rash of sweat glistens across his forehead.
What?
Farley says, pointedly.
I don't know what you're shiting on about, but leave Jesus out of it.
Why?
Just do it, Iswai. Show some respect.
Show some respect is just another way of telling people to keep their mouths shut.
Okay, keep your mouth shut.